Okay, welcome back. So while you all have been walking in, I've been quickly reading this book, Fish and Go. It reads very quickly. And now Bartek has made sure that my code is 10 times quicker. So tell us everything about it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, everybody. So welcome. I hope your travels went well. Mine were totally, you know, like canceled, flight canceled, change of route. So I had lots of adventures. But generally, I'm super happy I made it. And we are at the FOSDEM. So in this talk, I would like to invite you to learn more about efficiency of our Go programs. And there is already two talks that I have been on, who mentioned, you know, optimizations in its name and like generally how to make software more efficient. I wonder where this, it's not a hype, but it's already three talks about one topic. Why it's so popular? Is it because everybody's saving money? That might be a reason, but I'm super happy we are really uncovering this for Go, because Go alone might be fast, but that doesn't mean that we cannot, you know, doesn't need to care about, you know, making it better. And use less resources when we execute it, right? So let's learn about that. And turns out that, you know, you can save literally millions of dollars if you, you know, optimize some code, sometimes in production long term, so it really matters, right? But before we start, short introduction. My name is Bartłomiej Płotka. I'm an engineer at Google. Normally I work at Google Cloud, Google Managed Prometheus Service. But generally, I'm open source passionist. I love Go. I love distributed systems, observability topics. I maintain Thanos, which is like open source scalable Prometheus system. I maintain Prometheus as well. And generally, yeah, lots of things in open source. I mentor a lot, and I suggest you to check, you know, also try to mentor others. It's super important to bring new generation of people up to the speed in the open source. And yeah, I'm active in the CNCF. And recently, as you see, I published a book. And I think, you know, it's kind of unique. Everybody's doing TikToks now and you know, YouTube. And I was like, yeah, let's be old school. Because, you know, you need to be unique sometimes in the world. And I really enjoyed that. I learned a lot during that. And I would love you to learn as well. So I'm kind of summarizing of some concepts from my book here in this talk. So let's go. And I would like to start with this story, and you know, apparently some of the talks, one of the best talks, have to start with the story. But this is something that kind of maybe triggered me to write a book, right? So imagine that, I mean, yeah, that was kind of 5 years ago. We just started the project called Thanos, open source. Really doesn't matter what it does right now. But, you know, what happens is that it has microservices. It has, you know, I think 6 different microservices written in Golang. You put in Kubernetes or any other cloud, and it's just a distributed database. And one part of this database is compactor. It's like a component. Again, doesn't matter much what it does. What it matters is that it touches object storage, and it processes, you know, sometimes gigabytes or terabytes daily of metrics, right, of some data. So what happened is that at the very, very beginning of implementation, as you can imagine, you know, we implemented MVP. It kind of functionally worked, but of course, you know, the implementation was kind of naive, definitely not optimized. We didn't even run any benchmark right at all, other than just running on production and just kind of works. So and you're laughing, but this is usually, you know, what development in a high velocity looks like, and it was working very well. Until, of course, more people put load into this, and you know, we have some issues like OOMs. You know, one user pointed us to some graphs of, you know, incredibly, you know, high spike of memory usage on the heap, on the Golang heap, right? And you can see it's a drop, which means, you know, there was a restart or someone killed this. And the numbers are not small, like 15 gigs. I mean, for a large data set, maybe it's fine, but it was kind of a problematic, right? So it was really interesting to see what different feedback and what different suggestions community were giving us. And I mean community, everybody, like users, other developers, maybe product managers. We don't know sometimes who their role are, but you know, probably depending on their background, the answers, the proposals were totally different, right? So I would like you to kind of, you know, check and like check if you had the same situations in your experience, because you know, this is kind of like very ongoing problem, and I would like to showcase this. So you know, first suggestion was that, can you give me a configuration that doesn't OOM? And it's like, what do you expect me, like in the like very new project, to have like flags, not OOM or like useless memory? This is not as simple as that. Yet many users are asking us this question on open source project. Probably you heard this question. Okay, what configuration I should use so it uses less memory, right? Or like it's more optimized. How can I optimize using configuration? It's just, you know, it's not as simple as that, I guess. You know, maybe in Java, in JVM, you have lots of performance flags. You sometimes tune things, and it's better. But you know, it's not so simple. It's a goal, like kind of low level. You need to do more than that, right? Another, you know, interesting approach, but very, very good in some way, is that just okay, I would just put this process into bigger machine, and it's done. And that's totally valid, you know, solution. Maybe short term. Maybe sometimes it's enough. But you know, in our case, it was not sustainable because, of course, you couldn't grow vertically more and more. And also, even if you would maybe find a big enough machine that was working for your data set, then you know, obviously, you were overpaying a lot if the code is naive and maybe wasting a lot of memory, right? Then finally, you know, the most fun approach. Okay, let's split this one microservice into, you know, like a scheduler, and then, you know, workers, and then we'll just replicate in my super nice computer, you know, Kubernetes cluster, and, you know, it will just horizontally scale, so I can use many hundreds of small machines, so it will work. Yes, but, you know, you are putting on small kind of microservice so much complexity that it will be like more expensive generally, right? Because of the network cost, like distributed systems, you know, injects, you know, things that you have to replicate data finally. So you're overpaying more and more, and you are kind of distributing this non-optimized code to different places. That's not always the solution. Sometimes the code cannot be optimized more, and we should probably horizontally scale, but not in the very beginning of the project, right? Yet, that was the first suggestion from the community, right? Of course, you can just switch from Thanos to something else, right? That's also a solution. And then, well, if you have this approach, then probably you will just jump through project. This is not super efficient, but maybe, you know, some parts of the project are better or some worse. That's an option. Some suggested, of course, paying for vendor, right? Like, they will solve those problems for me for real money. But yeah, that's not always a good solution. Like that's just giving up, and also, you know, migration of data, huge cost of learning new tools, and so on. And you know, all of this work, where in the code we have this, and it's like, you know, it's bumping and super easy ways that could be avoided, right? And yeah, understand. So. You know, of course, that was malloc, so in C++, I mean, in Go, we don't have malloc and so on, but, you know, memory overhead, memory leaks like that, like, are very common in Golang. Like, just imagine how many Go routines sometimes you created, you forgot to close some kind of abstraction, and the Go routine is leaking, and so you are leaking memory like this malloc, right? So, and you know, what actually, you know, was the solution was some contributor finally came up, investigated, thought about this efficiency problem on the code level, algorithm and code level, right? And rewrote small part of the compactor to stream data, right? So instead of building maybe the kind of resulted object that the compactor is doing in memory, it was as soon as possible streaming that to file system. Easy, generally easy change. Yet there was lots of discussions, lots of stress, lots of weird ideas, and I would just found it like over time amusing that this story was repeating in many cases, right? So, and you know, that's not only, you know, of course, experience. So many kind of nice examples where only small character change, two character change there, and you know, so much kind of like improvement over like large systems. So sometimes there are like very easy waste that we can just pick it up and just do it, right? But we need to know how, right? So kind of two learnings from this story. One is that software efficiency on code level and algorithms, so changing code, you know, matters. And learning how to do it can be useful. And second learning is that there is common pitfall, I think, generally, in these years. Because in the past, we have premature optimizations. Everybody was playing with the code and trying to over-optimize things. I think now we are lazy, and we are more like into DevOps, into changing, you know, configuration, into horizontally scaling, because we have this power, we have cloud. And this is usually, you know, more chosen solution than actually checking the code, right? And I call it closed box thinking. And I think this is a threat a little bit in our ecosystem. So we should acknowledge that there are different levels. We can sometimes scale. We can sometimes put more bigger machine. We can sometimes rewrite to Rust, if that makes sense. But, you know, that's not the first solution that should come to your mind, right? Okay, before we go forward, I have 5 books to share, and I will share the link to quiz at the end. And it will be super simple, but pay attention, right? Because maybe there will be some questions around, and you need to answer, send me an email, and I will just, you know, just choose 5 people, lucky people, to have my book. So, pay attention. All right, 5 steps. 5 steps, for efficiency programs. One thing I want to mention, I don't know if you have been in a previous talk, or like before previous, he kind of explained a lot of optimization ideas. Like I think Maciej before, like he mentioned string optimization with interning. Jesus mentioned something around, you know, pre-allocations and many kind of like padding, struct padding, and generally, you know, all those kind of ideas. This is fine, but optimizing stuff. It's not like looking through dictionary of things I did in the past. It's kind of more fuzzy, more involved. So what I would like you to focus, it's not on particular how we optimize an example I will show, because it's super simple and trivial, but how we get there, right? How we found what to optimize, how we found if we should even optimize, okay? So focus on that. So first suggestion I would have, and this is from book, I kind of found, I defined this name TFBO, which is essentially a flow for development, efficiency-aware development, that worked for me. And generally, I see other professionals doing that a lot as well. So test, fix, benchmark, optimize. So essentially, what it is, it's like a TDD with something else. And TDD, you are probably familiar with, test-driven development. You test first, as you can see, and only then you kind of like implement or fix it until the test is passing, right? I would like to kind of do the same for optimizations as well. So we have benchmark-driven optimizations. Because as you can see, we benchmark first, then we optimize, and then we profile, right? And I will tell you later why. But all of this is a closed loop, right? So after optimizations, we have to test as well. Okay, so it feels complex, but we'll make one loop, actually maybe two, during this talk on a simple code. So let's do it. So let's introduce a simple function, super simple, super stupid. We are creating a slice with million elements, and each of those elements are just, a string, a constant string, for them. Super simple. It's the first, first iteration of this program we want to write. So what we do regarding TFBO? Okay, so we test, right? Now we have a code, for example, and we want to maybe improve it. We test of test-driven development, so let's assume I already had the test, right? But the test could look like this. And then, I'm ensuring, okay, it's passing, so nothing functionally I have to fix. So what next? So next is this measurement, it's a benchmark. And again, Hazes already mentioned how to make benchmarks, but I have some additions, extensions to that, that you might find helpful. Something I want to mention is that, we were talking about micro benchmarks, because the same level of testing behavior, like for example, like for this small function, like we have this create, unit test is totally enough, right? This is on micro level, we are making just unit tests, it's fine. But sometimes if you have a bigger system, you need to do something on macro level, like integration tests, end-to-end tests, whatever bigger, right? And the same happens in the benchmarks, right? This is micro benchmark. This is the kind of unit benchmark. There are also macro benchmarks I covered in my book. And then you need to have more sophisticated kind of setup with like load testing, with maybe some automation, with some observability, like you know Prometheus maybe, which measures over time some resources. But here we have a simple unit, create function. We can just make it simple with micro benchmarks. And you know, it has already mentioned, but you know, there is a special signature in a test file you have to put. And then there are optional helpers, for example, that I like actually to put almost everywhere. Report allocs, which is by default making sure that this function will measure allocations as well. And the reset timer, which is super cool because it resets the measurement. So anything before you allocate, you spend time on, it will be just discarded from benchmark result. So benchmark will only focus on what will happen within within this loop iteration, right? And then this for loop, you cannot change it. Don't try to change it. Always copy. This is a boilerplate that has to be there, right? Because it allows Go to make repeatable, check the repeatability of your tests by running it, you know, hundreds of times. Okay, so how we execute it already, again, as mentioned, but this is, you know, how I do it to like focus to one test. But this is not enough, in my opinion, right? There are, by default, it runs only one test, 1 second. I recommend to actually make sure you explicitly state some parameters, right? And I have one liner in Bash, for example, that I often use. So what it is, essentially, I'm kind of creating some variables so I can reference this result later on in a short-term future, V1, for example. So this will create a V1.txt you know, file in my locally. It will run this benchmark. It will actually run it you know, some time I specify, again, which is super amazing because it was like, okay, so I have this V1 file, what I was doing with it, and then you check in your bash history, okay, oh, that was 1 second, and then that was something else, right? So it's kind of useful. And then this is crucial. This is something I don't know why I didn't learn in the beginning. Maybe you learned, the count, dash count, right? So what it is that it runs the same test couple of times, 6 times actually. And so 1 second, 6 times. And this is super important because then you can use further tools you'll see to check you know, how reliable are your results. It will essentially calculate the variance between the you know the timings, for example. So if the variance is too big, then your environment is not stable, right? And then I pin to one CPU. This is super important to generally pinning, not to one, right? You just pick something that works for you for concurrent.